My name is Clarence Moriwaki, and I'm the founder and past president of the Bainbridge Island Japanese American Exclusion Memorial. And this is the site of the first Japanese Americans taken to concentration camps in World War II. Bainbridge Island was the place, starting on March 30th, where this whole sad story started. More than 114,000 people on the west coast of the United States were shipped away and forced to move and leave this part of the country. That was 95% of all Japanese Americans that lived in the United States at the time. Another 6,000 were born in the camp, so all told, 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans, two-thirds of them American citizens, were excluded from the West Coast. It was a shameful thing that our country did to people who did nothing wrong. You know, it's really strange because Bainbridge Island is an incredibly peaceful place. If you want to talk peace, this was the most idyllic place you could have. People worked together. Because it was a small island, maybe 3,000 people at the start of, you know, in the 1940s, everybody worked together. There wasn't a bridge off the island. You had to get along with your neighbors here on the island. And because the children went to school together, all the races mixed, the Swedes and the Japanese and the Filipinos and the Norwegians, you were just kids. And so people got along and got together, and it was perhaps a really nice model of what the American model is supposed to be, this melting pot of cultures getting together. And then the war broke out, and that was this incredible divide. On the rest of the country, it brought out the worst in us. It brought out fear and racial prejudice for the Japanese Americans anyway, and then of course hysteria. Here on Bainbridge Island, it was a little bit different. The editor of the papers, on the very day Pearl Harbor happened, Walt and Millie Woodward, the publishers of the paper, and they editorialized, you know, this is broken out, but these are our friends and neighbors. And then when President Roosevelt signed an executive order that started this forced exclusion in motion, Walt and Millie Woodward editorialized, you've broken the Bill of Rights, Mr. President. How can you do this? So he's speaking out on behalf of the community, and even went a couple steps further. He made sure that people in the island knew about their friends and neighbors, so we had young Japanese American people write back from the camps every week to let people know what was happening to their friends and neighbors, who got married, who went to war, you know, who unfortunately may have passed away. So they were always kept in touch and always kept in communication, so there was that conversation happening. He's the only newspaper we know of that did that during the war. And he also put, I mean, every point of view in there. As long as it wasn't libelous or incited violence or anything like that, there were people on Bainbridge Island who were in kind of what was then the mainstream of America. There was actually one letter writer who said, when this war is over, we got to have an island for the Japs, and you, Walt and Millie Woodward, you Jap lovers, you go with them. Those kind of letters. But fortunately, they were in a minority. And they set an atmosphere that kept the island involved and had them to be a safe place to come home to. It's odd that in time of war, that it brought peace to this island, because it showed that this island could come together. And this was an unusual place. 276 people were forced off this island after World War II started. More than 150 came back. Far and away the largest percentage of any community up and down the West Coast, because it was a safe place to come back to. Communities not far from here, Bellevue, Seattle, some of the Japanese Americans' businesses and homes were burned. I mean, they were arsoned. And here, most of the places were looked after. There's one story about the Ravens who took over a friend's property, and the Japanese American family sold it to them for a dollar. And the Ravens said, we'll take care of your farm, we'll look after it, we'll pay your taxes. They came back and they bought it back for the same dollar. So that's an amazing story. It's something we celebrate on Bainbridge Island, because there's so much sadness in this story. There's a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, a lot of pain that people went through. But that's not what this site's all about. It's about redemption. It's about hope. In the spite of all these things that are negative, in spite of all the horrible things that were happening in World War II, this place rose to be something different. So that's something we truly celebrate at this site. President Roosevelt signed an executive order on February 19th, 1942. It's called Executive Order 9066. It set in motion this entire forced exclusion. About a month and a week later, March 23rd, Civilian Exclusion Order number 1 was posted all over Bainbridge Island. And it said, all people of Japanese ancestry, in 6 days you're going to be taken away. March 30th was the day they all gathered at the very site we're sitting at. all 227 who were left on the island. They rode a ferry over to Seattle. They went on a train with the blinds closed, rode 3 days down to California to a place called Manzanar in the High Owens Valley, and they were the first Japanese Americans to be forcibly moved and placed into the first concentration camp. After about a year, most of them transferred to Minidoka, which is in southern Idaho. Then, after 3.5 years, they came back here to Seattle, to Bainbridge Island. I mention that story because when all that happened, when Roosevelt signed an executive order, it was deafening, the silence of people who opposed him. Congress was either mute in acceptance or mostly goading it on, especially California legislators. It was a land grab, it was racist, there were a lot of other motivations. It's easy to look into that history. The Farm Bureau and a lot of groups in California pushed this, including the Attorney General Earl Warren, who later became an incredible champion for civil liberties, but Attorney General of California with higher aspirations for office. He was pandering to the crowd, and he really pushed this. So California really pushed this movement. But finding people who opposed, like Walt and Millie Woodward, and they were noticeable because of their minority. They were noticeable because they were the exception. And when we started this project to become a National Historic Site, we had unanimous votes every time. Of course, our city council, Bainbridge Island, supports it, and the county commission. But our state legislature, when I went and did the strategy to do this, the state legislature unanimously supported this project. That's east, west, urban, rural, red, blue, from every corner of the state said this should happen. Contrast that to 70 plus years ago where it was the other way around. It's an incredible thing that time can heal. So this is a wonderful part of the healing. That's what we bring forward, saying the country is honoring you. It's a unanimous decision to honor you, the people who suffered this time. The sad part to me is that the majority of names on this wall are people who are no longer here that will never see this. And we're in a race against time, unfortunately. I mean, this was 73, 74 years ago. If you were born in the camps, you're 73 years old. And just like anybody in a World War II generation, it is a fading generation. And so we have future plans to do more at this site, but it's going to be a hollow ribbon cutting if there's not a survivor to cut that ribbon. Time is not our friend in completing this endeavor, unfortunately. Through this project, I'm not going to make this sound like it was just this beautiful Pollyanna, perfect thing. There were some people in our community, the Japanese American community here on Bainbridge Island, who did not want this to happen. They'd pull me to side, and what they would say is, you know, Clarence, this is great, but I spent 60 years trying to forget this. It's a pain, and every time there's a story about Pearl Harbor or someone, you know, doing something, it's like picking a scab open, and I have to relive this all over again. So some of the people were not really that supportive of the project. They didn't outright oppose it, but they weren't actively advocating and supporting, and that was a little frustrating. But I told them, I promise that we're going to do the best we can, and it's going to be a site that will honor you, honor your family, and hopefully heal you, because this is an important story to tell. So I understand that you really don't want us to do this, but I'm really trying to do this for you. And the best thing that comes from the end of that is, to a T, all of those folks, now that this is here, now that the government has created a National Historic Site, now we have this beautiful wall, they've all said, well, thank goodness you didn't listen to me. And so sometimes you have to push through that barrier. And I can't there's 120,000 stories out there, 120,000 families, individuals who went through this. So they're all individual. There are some who weren't so happy about the government. There are some who protested it, some who gave up their citizenship, some who refused to fight for the United States while my parents are behind barbed wire. How dare you make me go put my life on the line? So every story is different, but all of them are trying to be reflected in this site. We're trying to encompass all those stories. It is not a narrative. There is not a one Japanese American story. To do that would be falling into the same trap that America was doing against the Japanese Americans. Well, you're all like the enemy. You're all spies. We can't trust you. We can't separate the loyal from the disloyal. That kind of broad stereotyping is what got this horrible chapter to get started in the first place. And by the way, the Civilian Exclusion Order No. 1 was only for Japanese Americans. Executive Order 9066 allowed any kind of movement against any enemies of the United States, but there were no civilian exclusion orders for Italian Americans or German Americans. One, that would have been, I don't know, 40 million people or perhaps more. Two, it would have meant, oh, a guy like Dwight Eisenhower, a German-American, may not have been around to lead the Allied forces to victory. Joe DiMaggio, ironically named the Yankee Clipper, would have had to be in a concentration camp too. Of course, it didn't happen to them. And a commission started by Jimmy Carter in the 70s, finished by Ronald Reagan, was a bipartisan commission, spent 3.5 years exhaustively studying this period of history, looking at all the records, looking at all the documents. And they published a report in the 80s called Personal Justice Denied, and they came to the conclusion that this was not based on military necessity. No record of espionage. Even at that time, J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, said, I've got nothing. And he actually said, this is a very loyal group of Americans. He said, I wish most communities were as loyal as these Japanese Americans. He told Roosevelt that, you know, but didn't listen. But the commission said that it was based on fear, war hysteria, racial prejudice, and a lack of political leadership. That's what motivated this. And our motto here, it's not to put blame, guilt, or shame. It's about hope and moving forward. Didoto na yoni means let it not happen again. That's our hope. It's not about looking at the past, it's looking toward the future. Learn from the past, be inspired not to let it happen again. And if you take away that, then we've been successful in trying to communicate a message here at the memorial. And we dedicated this site, Nidoto na Yoni, let it not happen again. And then September 11, 2001 happened. And of course, we all know what that day is in American history. And we were all glued to the TV, I was. And the first thing that went through my mind is, I'm worried about my Arab American friends and my Muslim friends. And here in Seattle, I'm watching TV and there was a news flash. They said they're going live to a mosque in North Seattle. And the first thing that went through my mind is, oh, good gosh, is it on fire? Is it graffitied? And it was nothing of the sort. They went there, and the interfaith communities of Seattle and church council made a human wall around this building. They guarded this with their bodies 24/7 for days to prevent exactly what I was afraid of. And everybody had their moving moments on that day, and that was the first time I cried. Was, I can't believe people had this courage to do that. So these are eternal stories. We have to continue to tell them so we hopefully can get past a lot of that. Yeah, well, I grew up in central Washington, a town called Moses Lake. It's in the middle of the state. It's a lot more like North Dakota than it is western Washington. It's east of the Columbia River, and that's where the line of exclusion was for Washington State. If you were on the west side of the Columbia River, you went and were forced to move away. If you're on the east side, you were not. My father was in Moses Lake at that time, so he was east of the river and he was not forcibly removed. His story is really sad, actually. He was the oldest of 14 children in a town called Wallville near the Washington coast, a logging town. And when his 14th sibling was born, his mother died. And his father took away all but my father and his youngest brother. So his father took away 12 of his children back to Japan, leaving my 14-year-old father and my 13-year-old uncle here to fend for themselves. And he was in the eighth grade and he had to quit and make a living. And so he was pretty bitter about that. I think, I would guess, that my father's father, if he had enough money to pay for 14 kids to go, he probably would have taken them all back to Japan. But he made the choice saying, well, the oldest have the best chance to survive. But he was an orphan, and so he was pretty bitter, but he made his own way. He worked hard on farms. He then ended up in eastern Washington. So the war happened. He's not moved. He's not relocated. But he was drafted late in the war to what was called the Military Intelligence Service. This was a group of Japanese translators and linguists who were bilingual, and they worked on translation and breaking codes and in the Pacific Theater. This was near the end of the war, so he went to Japan during the occupation. And it's this wonderful thing. He's in the occupation. That's where he met my mother, who was from Kyoto, a young medical student. And so I have a foot in both worlds. I'm a Japanese-American third generation. I'm from my mother's side. I'm a second generation person. So it's an interesting mix there. And so I have the war to thank, I guess, for me being here. But I'll just step back a bit. My father never talked about this. I went to the University of Washington, and I remember going to the U as a freshman, leaving Moses Lake, and saying, wow, the best view of Moses Lake is Interstate 90 westbound at 60 miles an hour in the rearview mirror. Because Moses Lake was a very conservative town, not a lot of racial diversity, let alone ideological or political diversity, and I was much more liberal than the town, so I was eager to get to the U. And also meeting a lot of other Japanese American kids in Seattle. We all sat around as undergraduates, and one of the first topics where you go to school, and they went to high schools in Seattle, I'm from Moses Lake. And then the first question thrown to me, so where'd your parents go to camp? And I said, I'm a farmer's kid, we didn't have time for camp. And it was Kevin Kura from Bainbridge Island who said, concentration camp, you moron. I go, what are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. Never taught in my school. My father never talked about it. So I remember coming back Thanksgiving break, and you know, we were watching a football game. And I said, Dad, what's about these concentration camps? Do you know anything about? And my father was very verbose. You probably can't tell where I got that from. But he was always had a comment. And it was the first time he kind of paused. And he said this Japanese word was gaman. It's a word that means to persevere, to hold it within, to, you know, move forward, don't look at the past. And he said, you know, it's my job as a parent to give you a good life. Whatever happened to me in our past is not your concern. Which when I tell that to my Catholic and Jewish friends, they all say, man, I wish I was born Japanese. But, you know, so I learned that, and it wasn't, this is tough to talk. My father died day before Christmas, 4 or 5 years ago. And in his later years, it happens to a lot of older people. They don't have much short-term memory, but their long-term memory becomes incredibly lucid. And he was telling so many stories that even my mother couldn't remember or never knew, because he just could remember these details. And it was only, I think, about 3 months before he died that I finally got it. And he told this story. I told you he was drafted and became a sergeant in the Army before he went to Japan, and he's off to be shipped off to Japan in the occupation. And so he went to go see his uncle, who was at the Minidoka concentration camp in Idaho. He was on a bus from Portland to southern Idaho, a long bus ride, because back then they stopped everywhere, picked up mail and all that. So somewhere, I believe near Pendleton, he was off taking a stop, and this law enforcement official there saw him and threw him in jail. He's wearing a U.S. Army sergeant's uniform, and he's thrown in jail just because, hey, well, he's a Jap in my town. He's an American citizen, Army soldier, and he's thrown in jail. So he had to cool his jets for however how long, had to get out, and of course the bus didn't run like they do now all the time, so he had to wait a little while. Anyway, so he blew so much time in jail waiting for the next bus that he expected to be at the camp to spend at least 3 or 4 days with his uncle, his ailing uncle, but now he just got there and he has to turn right around to get back on the bus, or he's going to be AWOL and miss his, you know, shipment to Japan. His uncle, who had come to that gate every day for 4 or 5 days, looked at him and says, you good for nothing. I come every day, and you never came. You never told me why you're late. You know, he can't explain. He's only got 15 minutes, and he's got to get back on. You get on the damn bus. You don't care about me, screaming at him. And so my father said it was the loneliest bus ride he ever had, and his uncle died 3 days later. And he held this in until he was 3 months before his death. He held that in his inside of him all those years. And he was living gaman to the hilt. And so I'm telling that story because he did not have to go to the camps. He had, I guess, that luxury. I don't know. But he still lost. Everybody's story was connected to this some way. And so when I learned about it in school, at college, I took every Asian American Studies class I could, and the more I learned, the more upset I got, and the more, how could this ever happen? And when I moved here to Bainbridge Island, and knowing this was the first place in history, I mean, it was awesome. And they started this project in 2000, and the idea was to put a plaque at the Winslow Ferry Terminal, which isn't where it's happened. That's on the other side of the harbor where we are right now. It happened here at the Eagledale Ferry Dock on the other south side of the harbor. And I said, well, no, you can't put a plaque there. Once you put a plaque up, no one looks. But it didn't happen over there. You have to put it at a place. Connecting people with the place of where a historical event happens brings the story more alive, at least in a tangible way. You can say you're walking in the footsteps of history. where I'm sitting right now is where this story host started. This is where the first people being shipped off to the ferry were marching down this road, Taylor Avenue, behind me, and at the end of this wall is where the Eagledale Ferry Dock used to be. So you are literally walking in the footsteps of their history. So this is a sacred place. And that segues to a story that I always tell because it's quite remarkable. March 30th, 2002 was the 60th anniversary of when they were taken away. We just started this project. We had a little granite plaque that we were unveiling, and this was the start of this incredible dream. This property had not been purchased. It was a Superfund site. We needed $8 million to raise money to buy the whole property, and we didn't have any money to build the site. I mean, it was just all a dream. But we had this dedication ceremony, 700, 800 people lining this road all the way up, and beautiful ceremony. And then we made sure one part of it, we wanted to honor all 276 names. And so we started to read them by family. And as the names are being read, all of a sudden, these crows started to gather. And these crows were starting to come in and going, caw, 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 caw. Just these deafening caws. And there were times, even with a professional PA system, that my friends in the crowd said, we couldn't hear the names because those damn birds were so loud. And so we're all holding our breath because we're going to have that reflective moment of silence at the end of the last name. And these birds won't shut up. And at the end of the last name, it's like a switch went off. Went dead silent. Just like it is now. And we all took a sigh of relief. I was emceeing the ceremony, so I got up and I thanked everybody. And at the end of my thank you, these birds flew away. You could see them fly away. I thought, this is odd. One of the Suquamish tribal members, this is where they used to gather here, you know, for millennia, came up to me and says, Clarence, that was so incredible with the crows. And I go, yeah, their timing was pretty impeccable, don't you think? And she said, no, you know, we native peoples believe that blackbirds are the spirits of your ancestors. And even then, in 2002, those 276 names, the majority of them had passed away. I mean, it was 60 years ago. And so that really put a chill up my spine. It's something powerful about this space. I don't know, but there's something special about this place. Well, when I hear the word peace, especially in relation to this project, it's kind of ironic because it took war to make peace happen. It sounds strange to say that together, but it's been said many times, and Dr. Kitamoto, the president of our organization, he often said this, the opposite of love isn't hate, the opposite of love is fear. And I think that's very true, because at times of fear, people do irrational things that they would never do any other times. And latent things come out when people are scared that in normal civilian and civil discourse would not happen. To me, and perhaps most of the people involved in this project, when we talk about peace, it's weird because it was war that created a peaceful place. And when the war broke out, when there was a surprise attack against the United States by Japan, the fear and hysteria and then racial prejudice against anybody who looked like the enemy swept the nation, led by our president. That was a fearful time, hardly peaceful. But the story on Bainbridge Island, the community came together through support, through the peace and love of their friends and neighbors. That was manifest in a time when that was not the norm in this country. That's something that's incredibly remarkable. I think also by just designing this place to be a healing and honoring place, to make it a reflective, contemplative place, it is peaceful. We're sitting here today. People come here, tell me all the time, they come here to get that moment of reflection, that time to just sit and pause. Which is an unusual thing when you think at the time of the war. That was not a time to think. Everyone was reacting. Everything was reactive. What do we do against the many? How are we going to? And even when they're going through this process, think of it. If you were told you had 6 days' notice to take only what you could carry or wear, what are you going to do? You got to sell your property. They wore layers of clothing because they wanted to keep. Some people wanted to keep the suitcases for their diapers, so they wore layers of clothing. I mean, that was not peaceful. And then the camps themselves were not peaceful. They were difficult places to live. They had to go through all sorts of cultural changes, and there was all, and everybody's emotions, pain, humiliation, frustration, fear, anger. All those are antithetical to, they're opposites of peace. So how do we say that this place is a place of peace? How does a war create peace when all those things I just said, all those things in motion? It's because time helped heal and time people reflected. And the establishment of this site, it's brought peace to their hearts. It's brought peace to their families that they know this country is honoring them, that this community, and not only this community, but we are a national historic site. When an entire nation of legislators and the president all unanimously support this, that's a place of peace because it said, we're sorry, we made a mistake. A great nation, and I think we are one, when we figure out a mistake, we do try to right it. And I'm glad that our country has done that. Five U.S. presidents have apologized for this incredible error. It's called one of the worst decisions, violations of civil liberties in American history, ever. So the country can learn, but let's keep that vision forward because we are still in a, quote, war on terror, and civil liberties are being forgotten, unfortunately, to many people, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. So the story's not over. So we have to be vigilant. In order for peace to be strong, a country has to be strong. The citizenry has to be strong. Even in times when the government says something other way, if you know it's wrong, this is something I think we should tell our children when there's a person, the kid's getting picked on as a bully. That person's being violated. Stand up for them. There was an entire group of people, an entire group of citizens of the United States 70 years ago who were violated. Very few stood up. So I hope this site inspires people that it has happened in America. If you're not vigilant, it can happen again. After September 11th, the first thing that went through a lot of people's mind was the fear of what happens to Muslim Americans and Arab Americans. And interfaith groups did stand up. During that time, I heard two things. One, throughout media, throughout elected officials, I heard, well, this is our generation's Pearl Harbor. I heard that a lot. And the first thing I said, well, I certainly hope not. I certainly don't hope that we do this mass incarceration and all this fear. And the hopeful thing was, even on that day, September 11, 2001, September 12, you can go back and look at some of the video. There were many people who said, you know, we can't do what we did to Japanese Americans, you know, an uprooting of civil liberties. I heard that a couple times, and that was hopeful. It's easy to objectify people who are not like you. They do it, and it's not just the United States does it. Japan did this, Germany did it, every nation does this. You have to make your enemy not human in order to do such a horrific act to kill them. So you caricaturize them, you make them look like rats, or you do strange, you know, ugly, stupid propaganda, racist and the rest. So this is a human trait. We have to evolve from that. We have to move past that because it's always going to be the next person. Why do we always have to look for the next person to be at the bottom of the totem pole? I don't get that. So hopefully we learn from this. Sadly, I think it's going to take some evolutionary time, but hopefully time's on our side. Hopefully we're through projects like this, teaching people there's other ways. I would hope that not just this site, but any place that inspires you to be greater than what you are. Whatever those moments are that give you peace, use that reflective moment to go, I wish we could have this all the time. That's what I hope peace does for people, is to not only give you that, you know, obviously get that reflective moment, but also will inspire you, let's try to make this happen all the time. And when there are injustices, when stand up. You never know how that's going to touch people. You never know that what impact that's going to make. And if everybody does that, it's that kind of ripple thing. You know, it sounds touchy-feely, new agey, but I actually believe it. I actually believe that we are connected and actions matter. And I think people, if everybody did that, what is it that stops us? You know, get past that.